everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the You're a Biggest Fangirl podcast. I am one of your hosts, Victoria Malle. And I am so excited for today's guest. Someone who I fangirled over and now is a friend, Brandon Easton, is here today.
Hello. Good afternoon, everybody.
Yay. So for people who don't know Brandon, he is a writer, screenwriter, and educator based in the Los Angeles area. He participated in the ABC writing program and went on to write on season 2 of Agent Carter. In animation, he's written for Transformers Rescue Bots and Thundercats. He's also an Eisner-nominated comic writer, penning Catalyst Prime Incidentals for Lion Forge, and then most recently, Star Trek Year 5 and Transformers Galaxies for IDW. You may remember from episode 28 when I fangirled about meeting him at LA Comic Con and squeed about Agent Carter to his face for several minutes. So we're thrilled to have Brandon here in person with us today to discuss writing for different franchises and mediums across the fandom space, race in the comic book industry, and turning your passion into your profession.
Awesome. So I'm a big fan of just like space opera in general, whether it be Dune, Babylon 5, Star Trek, Star Wars. I'm a big fan of a lot of Japanese anime space operas like the Mobile Suit Gundam series. I'm a huge fan of the Universal Century storyline. Let me be very specific. There's a relatively unknown science fiction franchise out of Japan called Legend of the Galactic Heroes, which is probably the greatest space adventure ever committed to screen or print, in my opinion. And I've been just ecstatic that it's finally legally available in the United States. So I've made sure to spend my hard-earned dollars trying to support things I actually do like. You know, in terms of like comic stuff right now, I mean, I've been a huge Superman fan my whole life, huge fan of Spider-Man, Judge Dredd. Planetary by Warren Ellis and John Cassidy is probably my favorite comic book series of all time, period, you know. And I am a huge pro wrestling fan. I've been a fan of pro wrestling since 1980-something. I'm not going to age myself too much or date myself too much. And I've actually had the opportunity to do 2 nonfiction graphic novels based around professional wrestling, you know. So I've been pretty blessed as far as all my fandom goes, because I was just saying this the other day that if I had an infinity gauntlet of franchises that I wanted to work on, that I have worked on, it would be almost complete. Wow. Because when I do the math of it all, I've gotten to work on almost everything that I've adored as a kid and adolescent and so forth. And even as an adult fan, every now and then I have to pinch myself that I'm getting to put words in the mouths of characters that I just absolutely adore. So that's been blowing my mind.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Know? And a great segue into our next question for you. Oh, I promise you we didn't like give him the total cheat sheet. Because your Infinity Gauntlet is almost complete, and that's something that I think all creators strive for, is to complete their creative Infinity Gauntlet, which I love that metaphor and I'm stealing it. How did you get into writing for both comics and TV?
Well,
and then I know you've written for other things too.
Absolutely. But. Well, with comics, I originally broke in with a series called Arcanium from Dream Wave, not DreamWorks, but Dream Wave Productions from back in the late 90s and early 2000s. That was Pat Lee's company, you know. Incidentally, you know, in terms of the coincidence of it all, talking about Arcanium means I got to mention LaShawn Thomas, who was the artist on that book, who now has a animated series on Netflix called Cannon Busters.
Oh, yeah.
So LaShawn is at this point in his career, and then I'm doing all this stuff. So it's really wild to think that two guys who didn't really know each other got to work on a project together. And all these years later, we've all moved forward in our respective pursuits. That's why I originally got into comics. I did a Transformers Armada one shot. And then there was this massive break because I was a teacher in New York City for 6 years, and it was impossible for me to be a teacher and a writer. You know, I had to pick one, and I picked at the time teaching. But there was a point in time when I realized that I needed to go for my dream. And that's what I did. I moved out here to LA in 2008. Now, I'm leaving out a whole lot of stuff. I'm trying to keep this really fast. I went to graduate school at Boston University, and I got a master's degree in screenwriting. And as a result of that, there was a spring break program they had for students. And I was in that in the year 2000. And that's when I first visited LA. What wound up happening was some of the people I met during that internship process, they remembered me. And then years later, I was able to like reach out to them when I moved to Los Angeles. And a couple of them connected with me and blah, blah, blah. So that led to me eventually ending up on a Thundercats reboot in 2011. And then after that, I did Transformers Rescue Bots. And then right around that same time, my first original graphic novel, which took me like 8 years to do, called Shadow Law, that dropped in January of 2012. And that won an award. That was my first writing award ever, a best writer of 2013, I guess it came out, for Shadow Law from, it was a Glyph Award, which was absolutely amazing. Then after that, you know, I got to do a bunch of stuff here and there. I got signed with Lion Forge Comics. And I had like a bunch of stuff come out with them. The biggest project from them, of course, being the Andre the Giant Closer to Heaven graphic novel, which was a nonfiction biography about, you know, Andre Rusimov, otherwise known as Andre the Giant. And what made that particular project amazing was that I got to work with his daughter, who very few people realize was alive or even existed. As a wrestling fan, I knew a lot about Andre's in-ring career, but I knew nothing about the man. So because of her, I was able to create a more holistic image of who this person was for a wide audience. Then jumping ahead again in 2015, I got into the ABC writing program that led to Agent Carter. Then my like TV and graphic novel career started running side by side. Bunch of stuff happened. I did the Vampire Hunter D comic series, which is about to be collected, called Message from Mars, which led to me writing the pilot for Vampire Hunter D TV series, which I don't know the state of it at this point, but I did do that. And then that led to more Transformers work. And I did Mobile Armored Strike Command, also known as MASK, for IDW. I got along with those folks. And now that led to me getting on Star Trek Year 5. It's like a writer's room for this series because it's so big and involved. And there's a bunch of really cool stuff that's happening right now that I can't really talk about. But one of the biggest things is there's a brand new pro wrestling graphic novel that I co-wrote with pro wrestling legend Jim Cornette called Behind the Curtain, True Pro Wrestling Story. So right now, this book is now number one and number two in the Amazon wrestling area.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, because digital version is number two and the print version is number one. The special edition of 1,500 copies sold out within 4 days. So damn, this is like one of the biggest projects I've ever done. So I'm kind of like stunned by the reception of that. And so that's kind of my career in a nutshell. That's how I got into it. I'm leaving a lot out because so much of this business is politics, networking, hustling, a whole lot of failure. For every great success or whatever you want to call it that I experienced, there were about 25 losses. And I mean, brutal losses. These weren't just like losing by like 1 point. I mean, I'm talking about getting blown out and destroyed and almost falling out of the industry completely. Mm-hmm. And that's a whole other story, which we could talk about survival mechanisms.
Yes.
It's a very fine line when you talk about being a fan and a professional and write as a fan writing as a professional, because that's a whole other thing. You have to learn how to divorce the fan fiction of it all and concentrate on a story that will have an appeal to not only people who want to read it or watch it, but people who may not be interested. So you sometimes have to think outside the box while adhering to the rules of the license holder. So, for example, Star Trek, which I'm working on right now, and also there's a Transformers series I just finished called Transformers War for Cybertron Siege, which will be on Netflix in 2020. And that was like one of the biggest achievements in my career because I'm a huge Transformers fan. I mean, huge, ridiculously so, to the point of being embarrassing to some people. So what winds up happening is you have to adhere to the licensors. You have to follow their rules to a T. But you also have to push the boundaries just a little bit so it'll be a little bit interesting and off book a little, you know, if that makes sense. Like, I can't have Kirk and Spock, you know, grab lightsabers, you know, and start, you know, using the Force. But I can do things like show parts of Kirk's past that we all know existed, but was never seen in a book or a movie. Right. I'll give you an example. Like right now I'm writing Star Trek Year 5 and my issues of the series are a sequel to an episode called A Piece of the Action when the Enterprise crew ended up on a planet that was a 1920s gangster world, right? And they're going back, all this stuff is crazy, it changed, blah, 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 because of their interference with the culture. But there's a moment in the first issue that I wrote where Kirk gets to see his son, David. Now, if you're a Star Trek fan out there, Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, you learn that Captain Kirk has a son named David Marcus. The mother's name is Carol Marcus, right? If you count backwards from the date in Wrath of Khan, David would have been alive during the original run of the original Star Trek series, but we never saw him or heard of him. But I put that scene in there because I was allowed to. Wow. You know, cause it didn't hurt anything, right. But it further expands the tapestry of who Jim Kirk is. So that's the kind of thing that you have to approach. You have to be extremely aware of all the things that have come before, have sort of happening now in the franchise, but also what hasn't been dealt with. And I got very lucky to even think of something like that. It's a juggling act, but it is an amazing thing if you pull it off.
Right. Do you think being a fan in that respect, like just because when you're giving us that Star Trek example, it requires a love and knowledge of that franchise that I think a lot of fans have naturally. But then I also understand the heartbreak of having to divorce maybe those two identities when you're creating. So ultimately, do you think it's better to be a fan and then write as a professional or just to be assigned to something?
Wow, that's a damn good question.
Sorry,
wow.
It just came to me.
The reason, you know, I can answer that in 2 hours, the shortest possible version. The reason I even ended up here in Los Angeles is because when I was a teacher and I was in my last year of teaching, I got so tired of reading interviews in the Hollywood Reporter or Variety with somebody who wrote some science fiction epic or working in a science fiction franchise I consider epic. And the writer would say, well, you know, I wasn't really a fan of the property, but, you know, I had some people around me who explained to me. Well, and I'm like, no, this is why it doesn't ring true, because you don't know those little tiny things. And there are plenty of screenwriters and novelists and whatever who have written in franchises they're not fans of. And they're great examples of it. But I feel that when someone who is a fan is writing it and creating it, they add a little bit more of that love and that little sprinkle of sugar that a person who's not familiar with it won't have. You're right. I would say that it is better to be a fan, but not all fans have the ability to be professionals. And I'll use this term that I say about writing. Anybody can dance, but not everybody can be a dancer.
Right.
Anyone can write, but not anyone can be a writer. And with that being said, there are people who simply do not have what it takes. And I hate to say it that way, but I want to be very clear. They don't have what it takes to cross the threshold from fandom to professionalism, because those are two separate realities. And I've seen way too many examples lately of people who think that they are professionals who get in there and ruin it for everybody else. I'm a hardcore stickler about having a fence between the worlds of fandom and professionalism.
And I think it should be there. I think sometimes we get mad and like we run against it. But then like if it wasn't there, I think it would be a melee.
Yeah. And even with that, with gatekeepers up, it's still a nightmare because there's enough people who mess it up for everybody else out there who still get gigs somehow. So it's a tricky thing. And like I said, I can answer that. I could take a whole 2 hours to talk about that one subject.
I know. That's why we have to have you on. We're like, this will be a great conversation. We have to keep it a little brief, but... Also on this podcast, we've talked about representation, but usually in its diversity on like the front end or in the media you're consuming, where we talk about how important it is to have diverse characters and diverse actors.
Yes.
But it is equally important to see that representation on the creator side. Why is it important to also have the stories about these characters be told by diverse authentic voices?
That's another thing that I could answer in 3 hours if we had time. The short version is this. You need new and different perspectives, or else whatever you're writing is going to die. I talk about this a lot I do a panel at Comic Cons, at various conventions, and I talk a lot about the importance of diversity. Now, diversity and inclusion are two separate things. Diversity is just having different people around. Inclusion is the process of taking them seriously and melding their voice into whatever it is you're creating. There's plenty of diversity, but there's not a lot of inclusion. And it's very important. There are things that happen to me in my life that I could bring to a writer's room or a story that somebody who did not grow up like me, you know, it's not even just racially. It could be economic. It could be gender-based. It could be sexuality-based. It could be geographical even. But in my specific identity as, let's say, you know, I guess a cisgender or straight male from Maryland, which is the Mid-Atlantic, growing up Catholic and African-American, my perspective is very different than even an African-American guy who grew up in Georgia who's a Baptist.
Right.
That's not the same reality. There are shared cultural experiences and ideas, but in terms of day to day, I can bring something to a story that no one else can. And there are women who I know who, not by virtue of being women, but because they've had experiences in tandem with them being women, they can bring something to a story. Because I think talent is more important than anything else. Because I wouldn't want to hire a person of color or whatever just because they're that. But if there is somebody who I feel their perspective can bring more to the story and enhance it and make it better, then you do it. I mean, there are so many shows and comic books that are just dominated by middle-aged white men who have no experience outside of their own life. When they write women, and when they write, especially when they write African Americans, you can tell they have no black friends. You can tell that they've really not dated very much, because their idea of what women are and what men, what people of color or Latinos or Native Americans or whatever, or Asian people are, it just doesn't make any sense. And you see it over and over again. And you look at these writers' rooms and you look at the pictures, and it's just like, how is it you could throw darts somewhere in LA and end up with a room more diverse than the rooms that are hand selected? That to me is so horrible, because nothing changes and the stories get so... People say, why does network TV sucks? It's not that they're not talented people out there. They just don't hire them. And then they'll say, well, because the old argument was we couldn't find any. We couldn't find any black writers. We couldn't find any women writers. Now that you can, the argument is they have to fit the room, whatever that means. And it's just like, come on. You're making, just if you just said, I only want a room full of white guys I get along with, that's illegal, but at least you're honest. Don't make up a bunch of stuff to keep your room the way it is, or not hire people to work on like legacy characters. Like when you look at the pantheon of people who've written like Marvel big comics, the event books, or DC big event stories, there's not a lot of women, and there's almost no people of color historically. You know, and there's obviously a concentric circle of women of color who are, you know, but these folks are not getting the jobs. And the sales keep dropping, yet the same dudes keep getting the same gigs, and you wonder, what has to change? Did it ever occur to you, if you just had some fresher ideas, you might be able to reach more people? But they don't see it that way. They bet on the sure bet, which is declining sales, but they know they'll get at least 30,000, when in theory they could probably sell a million, but they never take the chance.
Another thing that I've seen is that, as someone else who works in Hollywood on the development side, so the people who hire the writers,
of course, yeah,
is that they're just so green. They're inexperienced. And it's like, well, they're green because they've never been given any opportunities.
No,
they're marginalized. They're marginalized. Right. And so, and then it's risk averse.
Fear.
I mean, I know this is like a very, very macro.
Yeah, no, that's a huge conversation.
Well, yeah, but also this is going to be a very macro reference, is like, but then you see like Taika Waititi doing Thor Ragnarok. Like, I feel like they would have been like, they were like, I don't know, this guy's only done like weird indies in New Zealand. I personally miss them because I'm a white girl from America and who is an Anglophile. Mm-hmm. So I'm like not as engaged in Maori culture. But I know he incorporated such a flavor of that. There are very specific references that I've like watched YouTube videos where they go back and illustrate. But because he was a fresh voice, he may have been greener as a director. He had never done a movie that probably cost more than honestly $10 million.
Right.
But they took that risk. And I also think it's almost even more important for the studios to take the risks because they're like, oh, well, there's so much money at stake. But I'm like, you also have the infrastructure to support a director like that. And then you see what he did. And Thor made almost $1 billion, and right now Love and Thunder is going to blow everyone's mind.
He brought an energy and an originality to something that could have been extremely stupid.
He saved the character, basically. Thor in
because,
the MCU.
Good God. And when you look at it that from, you know, and you gave that's a perfect example of opening the door to somebody with a different mentality who could bring a spin to it that nobody here is going to think of. Ryan Coogler with Black Panther is another great example. Patty Jenkins with Wonder Woman, yes, another great example, you know, and you can keep going down the list. And it's just that, like, just every time they just give somebody a shot, a lot of times you get amazing results and you think they would get it, but they just revert right back to the same type of dudes. And I'm not crapping on straight white guys, so please don't think I'm saying that. But the trick is, the problem is that they're not the only ones who are qualified. And then what the scarier part is that by virtue of being a straight white guy, even ones who are not talented are getting shots that far more superior creators out there won't get because they're not straight white guys. And I think that's the problem that we got to fix.
Representation, but I think we fail to mention or like really connect with the idea of like
Well, with comics, depending on the project, it's a much faster turnaround overall. If I write a script, it goes to the artist, illustrating the art team, and then I'll have probably a finished product within 30 to 45 days of when I handed that in. TV operates fast too, but it's a much more expensive and deeply involved process, obviously. I would say that they're both episodic in nature, but with comics, you have to think of how to convey a narrative in a series of still images versus television, where you're constantly moving forward. And those require two different ways of thinking about storytelling, because in TV and film, excuse me, and animation, constantly move forward. With a comic, it's static. So it's basically like laying out a series of photographs and assigning a narrative to those still images so that it makes a coherent story, even without word balloons. That's the real difference. I have to tap into more of my visual storytelling, purely visual storytelling gears in my brain, more so than just the acting, the theatrical side, like thinking about actors and voices and how people would say things and how much time they have to say it.
Yeah, you are just a bevy of knowledge and insight. And so I was lucky enough to meet you at LA Comic Con and yes. Artist Alley, but you've also hosted panels, one of which I've attended at places like WonderCon and SDCC. What's it like to be able to share your experiences and your insights with fans at conventions mm-hmm. and similar types of gatherings? And what do you get out of it? Like, obviously you wouldn't keep doing it unless you got something out of it.
I mean, wow. Listen, you two are just, you have some incredible questions. These are very good. I mean, I'm just sitting here like, wow, my brain is on fire right now in a good way. Okay, here we go. I really enjoy talking to people because as a writer, even if I'm working in an office, a writer's life is generally solitary. Like you spend a lot of time hunched over a computer screen at a desk, staring off into space, and then the rest of the time you're typing or finding reasons not to type because you're procrastinating. You don't really get a chance to get out there and do. I don't get a chance to get out there and do a lot of social stuff. Not as much I would prefer in my life, you know. So first things first, it's good to meet new people. Number one. I found that conventions, I've made more friends and made more new fans at conventions than anywhere else. So there is a kind of selfish motive for me just to connect with new people who normally don't get a chance to see me or don't understand who I am or what I've created. That's number one. As a former teacher, you know, there's a part of me that still wants to bring a clarity to the business, because so much of, I think, what makes fandom, what can make fandom toxic is a lack of knowledge about how the process actually works. And one of the things I've learned is the more you educate real fans and not just people who want to be trolls and complain, but people who have a genuine interest in this stuff, the more that they're educated to the reality of the business, the more appreciative I think some of them become. And they're less critical because once they understand how the business operates, it's harder to complain about certain things. You don't have to like something, but it's like I explained this to a dude once, that costumes can't look like the comic because in real life, people have bulges and curves and not every human being, thank God, and especially women, thank God, a lot of women are not size ones. You know, human beings aren't built like comic books are drawn. So you have to make changes for special effects, for human body dimensions and all these other reasons. And he just couldn't quite grasp the fact that it's just not Wolverine's costume as it is in the comic would actually look stupid in a movie. It just would. No matter how you try to do it, yellow spandex with like dog ears on top, it looks really stupid. And I think that I've brought a clarity and I've kind of deconstructed a lot of what it means to break in to the business as a writer, because a lot of people do not have a real understanding of that. So I want to make fandom and I want to make the process of writing as fun for people as possible, including myself. Because as a fan, still, when I shift back into my fandom, I have stopped complaining about things as much, because now that I've had the opportunity to work on stuff, I get how hard it can be and that no one's trying to make something bad. I think that's really what I get out of it, is just trying to connect with people and educate folks on the process of the business.
For sure. Yeah. The panel I saw was you were talking about breaking in as a writer, and I found it incredibly helpful. And then see when Brandon's at panels and go check him out.
Yeah. Please do. I always want to meet more people. It's so cool.
I think it's great that you're talking about like being a fan and how it operates. And this weekend, especially with D23 going on as we're recording this, I mean, we know that Disney Plus is coming out and MCU is expanding and it's getting bigger. There's all these new characters and works coming out. As a fan and a creator, is there a character that you would love to bring to life as part of this new expanding universe?
Well, I mean, I don't know if I'll ever get a chance to work at Marvel again. But in Star Wars, mm-hmm. you know, I would love to, I mean, I think somebody's handling this, but Darth Revan from the Old Republic series and also the Knights of the Old Republic games. Those who are Star Wars fans know what I'm talking about when I mention Darth Revan. You know, it would be the story of like George Washington and Abraham Lincoln all roll into one. You know, it's this amazing moment where someone goes into the dark side and is brought back to the light, but the stain of the dark side remains on his soul. And there's such a great moment in the Star Wars universe because of Darth, like it's a major turning point in the Star Wars universe. So Darth Revan, if I could get a chance to tell that story and really get into what being a Sith actually is and what a Jedi, what it means to be a Jedi and all that good stuff, I would love to do that character. You know, I think that would be a whole lot of fun.
And Disney is bringing it, like, so I feel like slowly kind of reintroducing some legend concepts and characters. So possibly.
They're going to have to.
Well,
Revan is, they've spoken about Revan as canon now. It's just that there's no story for it yet. I mean, I think there's a screenplay being written. There's Knights of the Old Republic movie being written, which means I'll never get to do Revan the way I would like to do Revan. But, you know, I'm glad it's being made. But that was a character that I would love to have, you know, touched on.
Cool. One character that you touched on that we are big fans of is Peggy Carter.
Yes.
She is such a beloved character.
Yes.
And we found it tragic that Agent Carter ended after its second season.
You and me both.
Yes. We've talked about this over alcohol many times. Do you believe she's been able to live on in a satisfying way in the movies and the MCU, especially with Captain Carter and What If coming out?
I would say that it would have been great to have a third season because we could have put a bow on that character and propelled her forward while setting up a lot. But it didn't happen. I do believe that fans of Peggy Carter were given a nice little farewell to her. They got to see her a couple more times before the end, before Endgame. And I believe that, I think for what the reality of the business is and the politics and all that, I'm glad that we got what we got and that's where we are. So I'm very happy that, I do believe, yes, she got a nice send-off. I don't know if she'll ever show up again. I don't know if there's really a reason at this point. I think that story has been completely told, but I am very, very thankful to have been able to touch the Marvel Cinematic Universe in whatever small way I could and could make my contribution. And my hat goes off to, you know, Agent Carter, and hopefully maybe someday they'll revisit it. But I just don't honestly see that happening, you know, but I think she got a good send off. Oh, wow. Because I have real world examples of this that go back to like forever. I'll say this. I mean, honestly, while nobody wants to see their show go, it is cool to see a show end in a moment when the characters all are people you still enjoy watching. I'll give you a couple examples. Like The Office, love it. One thing I will say about The Office is that it should have ended at the end of the episode when Pam and Jim get married in Niagara Falls. That final shot with them on the boat at the base of the falls wrapped up that entire show. And then it came back, and after Steve Carell left, it should have ended, but it kept going. And it wasn't like horrible, but it wasn't good. Mm-hmm. And that's a great example of a show where I think stayed around a little bit too long. Even though, you know, Bill Cosby is now, you know, in jail, like where he belongs, obviously. But The Cosby Show was one of my favorite shows of all time because of what it meant to me growing up. And that show should have ended in season 7, but it went on for an 8th year. And I was like, eh. And it didn't. Like, the final episode is one of the greatest final episodes of all time. But that's another show I think probably could have ended a couple of years early. Firefly didn't even get a chance to grow. And that would have been one of the hottest science fiction shows of all time. And that's an example of like just giving, like, I wish something would have just gotten a chance to go, you know? So I don't know. I mean, that's a good one. I mean, I don't want to see things go, but Babylon 5 showed us that 5 years is a perfect number for a TV series. So I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Back to the MCU. Mm-hmm. Would you rather be a henchman for Loki or Magneto?
I would say Magneto because I understand his point of view. Loki just seems like an immature brat who just can't get over the fact he doesn't get what he wants all the time. Because he's a god. Well, not really, but, you know, they have infinite power and he can do all this cool stuff, but yet you want to be bored just to create havoc? I mean, I don't know. Whereas Magneto, especially, it depends on which version, but the version from the movies, I feel I understand his point of view, you know, him being a Holocaust survivor and holding a obviously understandable grudge about that. Magneto has a point, has an end game in mind other than just power. He wants his people to be free of oppression and strife, and he wants to provide them sanctuary. His methods, I'm not particularly fond of. Like, I would never kill anybody to achieve my goal unless, like, you know, it was a Civil War scenario. But I do believe that Magneto's point of view is completely understandable, and I completely respect it, minus the murder. But, you know, Magneto, definitely. He's badass.
Gotcha. Respect. Mm-hmm.
Well, somebody who had to wait a very long time for a Star Wars sequel between 83 and 1999, as someone who had to wait very long between Blade Runners, which is one of my favorite, you know, franchises of all time, something I would like to work in but have not yet. I'm okay with waiting. I'm a very patient person. If there was a show, for example, like a Blade Runner TV series and Harrison Ford wasn't in it or, you know, whatever, it would kind of be stupid. I would be very upset because I'm like, I'm getting to see the world, but I want to see what's going on with that character. Whereas if I get a movie that's all about that character and I got to wait a few years in between, but it's dope and they spend a lot of money on it, I'll wait. I'm all right. I can wait.
It's worth it.
It's worth it. Yeah. Gotcha. Absolutely.
Would you rather see a musical episode of your favorite TV show or a crossover episode with your two favorite TV shows?
Oh, crossover, without a doubt. Oh, yeah, crossover. I mean, a lot of shows I've loved growing up crossed over. One of the things I would say, there's a theory that all TV series actually operate in one universe. And there's actually a way to prove that. And it's a long story. I'm not going to do it now. That's an example of what I'm talking about, crossovers. I would much rather have a crossover. Ooh, wow. Yeah, when you're that person that's not, that doesn't have powers on a super team, yeah, you're a liability. So I would rather be the person with powers and lead a team of like super professionals who are like I would handpick a team of like a squadron of just perfect soldiers or whatever, or like whatever they need, like a Mission Impossible scenario. But I don't want to be like the if you read Justice League from the 90s, Maxwell Lord, who turned out to have powers. But for a long time, you thought Max Lord was just a benefactor of the Justice League. Because if you go out on the field and you can't contribute other than with a gun, I'm just like, yo, that doesn't make sense. You know, I like Black Widow and all, but, you know, I'm just like, yo, not only Avengers, Captain Marvel, yeah, because she can like blow up a planet, you know, but Black Widow is just like, yo, you just fire guns. You're not even using the weapons they have in the comics. And, you know, it's like, I don't know about this. So I just feel that, you know, a depowered person on a super team, you have to be extremely good at something, but I think on the field it's a liability. That's just my opinion. You know.
That's a really interesting insight that we've never gotten before for this question.
Yeah.
So appreciate it.
Sure.
Also, we appreciate you coming here and
absolutely
fanning out with us. Mm-hmm. Where can everyone find you on social media and support your work?
Oh, thank you. I'm mainly on Twitter more than Facebook, but I'm on Twitter at Brandon Easton, and that's how it sounds, BrandonEaston. I'm on Instagram at Brandon Easton Writer. I'm on Facebook, you can find me. But I also do a couple of podcasts of my own. One is called Writing for Rookies, which is basically what it sounds like. It's a tutorial. And I do another podcast with Brandon Thomas, who is a comic book writer as well, called The Two Brandons. And we talk about pop culture and writing and blah, blah, blah. So I'm always, you know, open to talk to people and connect with people online. So feel free to hit me up. And if you see me at a con, just walk up and say hello, because I'll be really happy to talk to you.
Fantastic. And fangirls, if you enjoyed this episode with Brandon, please subscribe to us on your favorite podcatcher and leave us a rating and review so we can have even more fantastic guests on. And we will see you next time, fangirls. We're going to go scream to Brandon about Agent Carter a little more off air.
Our theme song is California Lullaby Instrumental by Josh Woodward, used under Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 International License.